You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
I'm here today to talk about a certain aspect of prayer that may seem a little controversial, but biblically it's not, and that is arguing with God in prayer. Arguing with God in prayer, that's right. How many like to argue? A scattering of hands. How many would say, I hate to argue? Yeah. I totally get it. And, you know, it's understandable why we don't like the tension, you know, when someone's angry with me and they want to engage me in argument. I don't like the tension. I don't like the relational tension. If I feel tension towards someone, I don't really want to start arguing with them because I don't like the relational tension. And truthfully, we don't argue all that well. Part of the reason we don't like argument is because we're so bad at it. You know, we tend to be self-deceived. You know, who hasn't entered into an argument thinking they were right? Now you got two people who think they're right if it's just a two-person argument. So we tend to be self-deceived. And a lot of scientists have demonstrated this. We are self-deceiving. Also, we tend to justify ourselves automatically. It really just takes milliseconds between an accusation and we will automatically start justifying ourselves. It's part of being fallen. So that tends to make argument not that fun, at least for the person that's trying to bring something up to you. We tend to listen really poorly. It's probably tied up with being self-deceived and automatic justifiers, as we tend to not really listen that carefully. I've been in arguments with my wife before when I suddenly realized she wasn't arguing with me. I thought she was arguing with me, so I start bringing my arguments out, and I suddenly become aware, oh, you're not even saying that, are you? How long have I been? I was trained to be a listener. Not so good. And I think we can be punitive in arguments, right? We can be disrespectful in arguments. And all of those things would argue for not arguing. But healthy relationships with other people require argument. Because, you know, I experience you in a certain way and you experience me in a certain way and we may not like it. There's things we may see that concern us and that we want to bring forward. And I know a guy whose parents never argued, ever, until the day they told the children we're divorcing. Right? Healthy relationships require argument. And I think a healthy relationship with God requires argument too. Fortunately, the Bible is full of plenty of examples of people arguing with God and even how they argue with God. And that's what I'm hoping we'll learn from today. And so, look at Job. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. I would learn the words which he would answer and perceive what he would say to me. That's just one of many. Abraham argued with God about Sodom and Gomorrah. God is with his angelic companions, and he said, shall we reveal to Abraham what we're going to do? We're going to go down to Sodom and Gomorrah, and we're going to destroy this city. And now God knew there were no righteous people in this city, but he permitted and encouraged Abraham to argue and haggle with him about this. He knew the result, but he still invited Abraham to do this. I think this is why Isaiah points out that Isaiah says that Abraham was a friend of God. It's part of what friends do. Moses argued, and I'm going to show you an extended argument of his in just a bit, about God having mercy on Israel. At one point, as you'll see, God said, leave me alone, I'm going to destroy this people. And Moses, I'll make from you the nation. And Moses immediately launches into arguments. Abraham, when he's arguing with God, is like, far be it from you, God. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right? Habakkuk. These people of mine are so corrupt, God. Why aren't you doing anything? I will. I'm bringing in Babylon. What? They're worse than we are. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. You know, Jesus, when he said Father, don't hold this against them. That's a request, but what's the argument? Because they don't understand what they're doing. When Jesus said, let this cup pass from me, we don't have any record of his arguments, but we have three long prayer sessions that Jesus has with the Father. I can't say for sure, but I'm certain there were arguments in there, like, don't you love me? I can't stand the idea of being alienated from you because we've been together forever. Paul asked God to remove a thorn from his flesh three times. I'm assuming there was some argument. I don't know. I'm assuming with Paul, there's some argument in there too. Like, I could be much more effective if I didn't have this problem. Spurgeon said this, and I thought it was really kind of interesting. The best prayers I've ever heard in our prayer meetings have been those which have been fullest of argument. Sometimes my soul has been fairly melted down, where I've listened to the brethren who have come before God, feeling mercy from God to be really needed, and that they must have it, for they first pleaded with God to give it for this reason, and then for a second, and then for a third, and then for a fourth, and a fifth, until they've awakened the fervency of the entire assembly. Arguing with God in prayer. All right. We're going to narrow. This is really actually quite a large topic. I landed on this in the summer when I began reading through Ajith Fernando's commentary on Deuteronomy. And when we got to the chapter on chapter 9 of Deuteronomy, you know, Deuteronomy is largely Moses' recollection of the entire history of Israel with God. And so he's recalling this incident we'll look at here in a little bit from Exodus, where they rebelled against God, and God said, stand back, I'm going to destroy them, and I'll make of you a great nation. And so as I was reading this chapter by Fernando, I thought, I love this guy. He's very scholarly, and he's very pastoral. It's so rare to have both. And I began to noodle on this idea of a teaching on arguing with God. So that's where it came from. But it's such a broad topic, I thought we're just going to narrow down to one person's argument. Eventually, it's going to take a while to get there. Once we get there, we're going to look at Psalm 143, where David is arguing with God about his own personal situation. But I want to consider a few points first. Isn't it impudent, disrespectful, to argue with God? You could see that, and frankly, there appear to be some scriptural support for this. Indeed, O man, who are you to reply against God? Will the thing formed say to him who formed it, why have you made me like this? And what about this? Isaiah says, woe to the one who quarrels with his maker. An earthenware vessel among the vessels of earth, will the clay say to the potter, what are you doing? And so these passages suggest that arguing with God is disrespectful, impudent, really. I think it depends on what you're arguing about. These passages and a couple of others in Jeremiah and another one in Isaiah that say very similar things, like, who are you, are arguing that God has no right to do what he's doing. He has no right to rule. He has no right to act. And that is impudent, because God has every right to act. And as these passages point out, he made and owns and rules everything. He has every right to do what he wants. But if you argue that you want God to do something else, it is not impudent. You're not saying you don't have the right to do this. You're saying, would you please not do this? Why would God encourage argument? I think we've kind of talked about this a little bit. We don't always know if a situation that we're in, so let's say someone, doctor tells me I have a diagnosis of a certain chronic disease, and that's the situation I'm in, and I don't know whether that situation is going to play out to my death or if that situation is something that is contingent. That is, God may change the outcome if I ask him about it, if I argue with him about it, if I talk with him about it. So I don't know whether the situation the doctor tells me I'm in is contingent on my reaction and response to God or not. I don't know. And sometimes God will reveal something, like Hezekiah, you're going to die. David, your son is going to die. Habakkuk, I'm going to judge the nation. Moses, I'm going to destroy the people. All of these things I just said are in the Bible, but it's not clear that some of these are contingent. If there's intervention, then they don't happen. In some cases, they're not contingent at all. And we're always in the situation, whether I'm in a situation or I'm responding to a revelation, I don't know. And so I need to argue with God about this, regardless of the outcome, because I don't know whether it's contingent or not. I think this is, contingent means to be dependent on or conditioned by something else. Like God says, I'm going to do X, but it's actually contingent on what I do about it. Some action I might need to take, some argument I might want to make with God, some recruiting of others to plea for me to God on my behalf. I just don't know. And so we argue because we don't know. We're agnostic. We are ignorant about. I think, too, God encourages argument because he wants us to run toward him, not away from him. I heard a story about a guy whose son did something wrong, and the father called the son to himself, and the son just charged right out the back door. The father didn't want that. He wanted the son to come to him, but the son ran away from him. What's the kid going to do? You know, he's like halfway down the street, like, now what? Where do I sleep tonight? Where's my food? You know, so he comes shuffling back, thank God, and then, you know, the father doesn't want to have his kid run away frightened. He wants him to come near. This is a chance to learn. God wants us to refine our understanding of him. One example of this I think is kind of interesting is in Matthew 15, there's a woman, a non-Jew, who's got a daughter with a very serious and severe problem, and she comes to the disciples and to Jesus, and she's pleading, apparently quite loudly, that Jesus would have mercy on her child. And interestingly enough, Jesus doesn't react at all. Wouldn't that be irritating? Save my daughter. I'm freaking out. Would you save her? Silence. And the disciples are saying to Jesus, would you tell her to go away? She's yelling at us. And so Jesus says to her, it's not good for me to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. Well, that would tend to make me want to tuck tail also. But this woman, her confidence in Jesus' capacity to do this led to her arguing with him. She said, well, even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the children's table. And Jesus, like, she's healed. This is great faith. And so what was he doing in his silence? What was he doing in his kind of crass comment? I don't think it was intentionally crass. Everyone knew the Jews regarded Gentiles as dogs, and they referred to them that way. But the fact he said that actually invited her to engage him in argument. He could have just said, your daughter's healed. But he invited her to argue with him by saying, don't throw the children, I'm not going to throw the children's food to the dogs. He wants our understanding. And guess who else learned a little something that day? The disciples. They had to walk away thinking, why was he silent? Why did he say this? And what happened? I think, too, God wants us to be compassionate intercessors like him. Now, God is so compassionate toward human beings that when he saw no one could solve the problem of human sin, He solved it himself. He conferred with the rest of his God nature, the Son and the Spirit, and the Son volunteered to take on human flesh and to die in the place of humankind for human sin so that people could pass from judgment. God is a compassionate intercessor. And it's interesting that when you look at leaders in the Bible that are great leaders, they are also compassionate intercessors. Why did God let Abraham haggle with him? The minute Abraham said, say there are 50 righteous people in the city, you're going to sweep away the righteous and the wicked together, are you? Now, God totally, he wasn't going down to Sodom and Gomorrah because he had no idea what was going on down there. He knew exactly what was going on. He knew there weren't 50 people. And he's like, I won't for 50 people. Okay, I'm sorry, but what if it's 40? This is like being in a flea market. And what if it's 30? What if it's 10? And God said, for 10 righteous people, I will not destroy this city. But there weren't 10 righteous people in the city. Why did God even bother engaging Abraham in this sort of haggling? Because Abraham is a compassionate intercessor. He says to God, when he's haggling with him about this, he says, will not the judge of all the earth do right? What's that? What argument is that? He's arguing it's not in your nature to do this, to sweep away the wicked and the righteous together. Here's a great one, all for all of us that are heading toward octogenarity. You know, there's three octogenarians who were standing up in the mountains when Joshua was fighting the Amalekites. So they didn't know on the ground where the fighting was happening. They had no idea that they were doing worse on some conditions and they were doing better in other situations. They didn't know it was all dependent on Moses holding his staff up. It's a symbol of his intercession for them. And Moses got tired, you know, so at one point, you know, he sits down and then his arm is really tired, so he lowers it down, and then Aaron on one side and Hur on the other side keep the staff in there. They hold his arm so he can keep it up. You can be God's secret intercessors that are the weapons more powerful than the situations you're praying for. No one will know. The only reason we know is because Moses wrote the book about what happened that day. Otherwise, we wouldn't have known. And no one will know that you're stepping up as an older person to intercede in great battles and everyday grace. No one will know except God. And one day it'll be revealed that you are a compassionate intercessor just like Abraham, just like Moses, just like Jesus himself. It's God's own nature. And so when we intercede, we're God's hidden warrior. How about that? How would you like to spend the rest of your life becoming more and more skillful at being God's hidden warrior? Corrie Ten Boom spent the last 5 years of her life unable to communicate with anyone, but she prayed. I'm sure she didn't want this. She was an active person. She was an accomplisher. Now all she could do was lay in bed. People would come and pour out their problems to her. She would close her eyes, because she's praying, presumably, and then she'd open her eyes and smile. That's how she spent the last 5 years of her life. I wonder if we're going to find out that was more fruitful than everything else she ever did, or at least contributed to all the fruitfulness of her life. Have I convinced you? I hope so. I'm going to read this. It's long, but I want to read it because I want you to see an example of Moses arguing. Let me alone, God says, that my anger may burn against them, that I may destroy them, and I'll make of you, Moses, a great nation. Immediately, Moses entreated the Lord and God and said, Lord, why does your anger burn against your people, whom you brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and mighty hand? What's he arguing? These are your people. You redeemed them from Egypt. And here's the next argument. Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent God brought them out to kill them in the mountains and destroy them? Stop for a second. What's this argument? You redeemed them from Egypt. Now you're going to kill them? What do you think the Egyptians are going to think about you? That you have evil motives. In Deuteronomy 9, Moses is recounting this, and he brings up the other thing, is that they will say, God, you are too weak. You're evil, or you're weak, and your name will be mud. Now, God could care less what we think about his name, except if we have a high view of who he is, we move toward him. If we have a low view, we move away from him. God is very, very, very zealous for his own name because he wants to redeem people. I'll go on. Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. This term, change your mind, is naham, which means to because of compassion, change the direction. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, or also known as Jacob? These are the patriarchs. So what's he doing now? He's going to argue from the fact that God made promises. These are your people. It's going to ruin your reputation. And you made promises. And so he says, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants whom you swore by yourself and said to them, I'll multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and all this land which I've spoken, I'll give to your descendants. They shall inherit it forever. And so I think, especially I'm thinking about Jacob or Israel. He had 12 kids, and God said these 12 kids are going to be 12 tribes, and they're going to inherit the land. Moses is one guy in one tribe. If he destroys all the rest of the people, and he's the one that's left, he has lied to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. It's not his nature to lie. So the Lord, Naham, changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. Why would God say he was going to destroy this people if he knew he wasn't going to destroy this people, if it wasn't his nature to destroy his people? Because he's pulling Moses into a role that is his very own. Psalm 143. Psalm 143 is a psalm of David. He's in trouble. And in fact, I would be tempted in reading this to stick it under the category of a lament, which we'll talk about in a couple of weeks, because there's a lot of lamenting in here. But I think it's a great example of arguing for yourself, not just for others, but for yourself. Hear my prayer, O Lord. Listen to my plea. Answer me, because you're faithful and righteous. Don't put your servant on trial, for no one's innocent before you. My enemy has chased me. He's knocked me to the ground and forces me to live in darkness like those in the grave. I'm losing all hope. I'm paralyzed with fear. I remember the days of old. I ponder all your great works and think about all you've done. I lift up my hands to you in prayer. I thirst for you as a parched land thirsts for rain. Selah. Which means we're going to pause for a second and think about this. That's what you're supposed to do when you see that word, pause and think. So he's in a lot of trouble. And we see the beginning of his argument. This is really just he's laying out the problem mainly in this section of the psalm. But the argument begins, answer me, why? Because you are faithful and righteous. Don't put your servant on trial, for no one is innocent before you. If this is about me being sinful, no one in the world can stand underneath your righteousness. Let's go to the next section. Come quickly, Lord, and answer me, for my depression deepens. Don't turn away from me, or I'll die. Let me hear of your unfailing love each morning, for I'm trusting you. Show me where to walk, for I give myself to you. Rescue me from my enemies, Lord. I run to you to hide me. Teach me to do your will, for you're my God. May your gracious spirit lead me toward on a firm footing. For the glory of your name, O Lord, preserve my life because of your faithfulness. Bring me out of this distress In your unfailing love, silence all my enemies and destroy all my foes, for I am your servant. See the argument words here? Answer me, for my depression deepens. Don't turn away from me, or I will die. Let me hear your unfailing love, for I'm trusting you. Show me where to walk, for I give myself to you. Rescue me, and it's implied, for I run to you to hide. Teach me to do your will, for you are my God. You know, lead me, for the glory of your name, Lord, preserve my life because of your faithfulness, for I'm your servant. These are the arguments. So this is a lament, but it's also an argument. How do you argue with God? Now we're getting down to brass tacks, as Mama used to say. I think for one thing, you be specific about what you want. You know, Jesus was walking along one day, and some blind men were yelling out, "Have mercy on us, Son of David." And that's a general sort of desire. And Jesus said, turned to them and said, "What do you want?" And they said, "Open our eyes." And he said, "Okay, it'll be done to you." And their eyes were opened and they could see. Specify. What do you want? Give us traveling mercies, Lord. What do you actually want? Be so bold as to name it. Dwight Moody, interesting cat, became a believer at 18, the person who led him to Christ, who taught him about the way Jesus provided to God through his own atoning death. At 18, he was largely, he wasn't an orphan, but his mom had a lot of kids. Dad died. They were extremely poor. She farmed out the kids to places where they could get food. And he was the guy who led him to Christ, described him as a very dark soul. He was working in his uncle's shoe store, and this guy explained Christ to him, and he became a believer. And when he was 18. Now, there's this story about Moody, which is this. He prayed daily for 100 friends his entire life. I don't know how the list was formed. Maybe it started with one friend and eventually worked its way up to 100. I don't really know. But whenever one of his friends would come to Christ, would turn to God and ask to be forgiven through Christ, check it off the list. By the time he died, 96 of the 100 people had come to Christ. And the final four came to Christ at his funeral. Be specific. What did David want specifically? Well, it's clear he wanted God to hear and respond to him, right? Hear my prayer, Lord. Listen to my plea. Answer me. That's pretty specific. Come quickly, Lord. Answer me. Don't turn away from me. Let me hear of your unfailing love each morning. But he wanted to hear God to hear and respond to him because he wanted something else, more specifically. He wanted to be rescued from harm. He was being harmed somehow. He was under threat somehow. And he wanted to be rescued. I doubt anyone here is under the physical stress that he was under the strain of being attacked that he was under the danger that he was under. No one here has probably suffered this way. But we do have an enemy that hates us and hates the people we love. We can ask God specifically to rescue us, to rescue others as well. Rescue me from my enemies, Lord. Hide me. Preserve my life. Bring me out of this distress. Silence my enemies. Destroy my foes. I was singing "A Mighty Fortress Is My God" on the way in today because whenever I start singing, that's usually the one I start with. And there's an interesting thing about that is he's basically like the world powers, no thanks to them. Your strength endures. One little word will crush Satan. Though the world with demons filled should threaten to undo us. You know, there's all this. And Luther, David here, was under actual physical threat. But his focus in his song is more about threat from God's enemy. And so we can ask to be rescued from harm. We can ask that God would rescue other people that we're worried about from harm. Be specific. Now, this is an interesting thing that you could pretty much miss if you read through this psalm quickly. I only picked it up because another author pointed this out. John Piper pointed out that there is sprinkled throughout this a couple of places where David is asking to be more godly, which seems like an awfully important prayer, because when, I don't know about you, but when I'm under stress, when I'm fearful, that's when my sinfulness bubbles up. And so it seems appropriate that if I'm asking God to rescue me, I'm also asking him to heal, to show me how I can be more like him, because my temptation is going to be to take matters into my own hands. My temptation is going to be to try to dominate a situation. My temptation is going to be to live like an orphan. And so it would be good to ask God to actually help me stay close to him and hope in him. Don't put your servant on trial. He knew he wasn't an innocent person. Don't put your servant on trial. No one is innocent before you. He wanted to be godly. He says, show me where to walk. I might be tempted to walk this way, but show me the way that I can walk in this situation. For I give myself to you. Teach me to do your will. May your gracious spirit lead me forward on firm footing. You can't go wrong sprinkling your arguments with momentary reflections on what you need in your own character. Because, and I don't know if you've ever listened to prayers where people are just pleading for themselves or pleading for someone else, and they get more and more outlandish in the stuff they're saying. They aren't aware that they are being lured into sin by their hardships. Can't go wrong sprinkling your prayers with desires to be godly. And then once you specify what you want, I think, and you can sprinkle this throughout, but make your case to God. What do you mean, make your case? Well, there's all kinds of arguments we find in the Bible that you could pull forward. Maybe not in every situation, but you could argue from your need. My enemies chase me. That's my need. He's knocked me to the ground. My need, he forces me to live in darkness. I'm losing hope. I'm paralyzed with fear. Come quickly, answer me, for my depression deepens. Don't turn away from me or I will die. That's his need. You can argue with God from your need. And frankly, we'll look at this in a couple of weeks, but lamentation is arguing from your need. I think you should argue from your desire to trust God alone. I think part of what arguing with God should accomplish in us is it should get us to keep orienting toward him. You know how sometimes you get into trouble and you just stop praying. But in inviting us to argue with him, God's inviting us to draw near, and asking us to draw near, we've sort of got to make decisions. Am I going to trust him or am I not going to trust him? Am I going to throw off a few quick ones? Have mercy, God. Traveling mercies, and then off with my life? Or am I going to realize the biggest problem I'm having right now is trusting him, and I want to trust him? And so we read David saying, I lift my hands to you in prayer. I thirst for you as parched land thirsts for rain. I give myself to you. I run to you to hide. What's he saying over and over again? I'm trusting you. I'm trusting you. I'm trusting you. I want to trust you. I need you. I have no other solutions. I think, too, we could argue from not just our need and our desire to trust God, we can argue from our status with God. And he does. Don't put your servant on trial. And then in the end, for I am your servant. That's David's status before God, as he's God's servant. And in this culture, if you had a servant as a master, you're responsible to take care of that servant. If they needed discipline, you disciplined them. But if they needed help, you helped them. That's your responsibility. And he's appealing to his status with God as a servant of God. I'd be reluctant to say this because I don't think I'm always that awesome as a servant. But our status isn't really dependent on our behavior. It's dependent on his orientation toward us. He called David forward to be a king. That's God's call. And so he's, when he brings up the fact he's a servant, he's not like, I am so awesome, you should take care of me. He's saying, you designated me a servant. Take care of me. And for those who've come to Christ, who've gone to God and realized Jesus died for your sins and asked to be forgiven on that basis, something wonderful happened when you turned to him and said, please forgive me through Christ. You became his child. To all who believed, that is Jesus, and accepted him, he, Jesus, gave the right to become children of God. I am a son of God. You are a daughter of God, a son of God. If you've made that decision to come to Christ, you can go to God and say, Lord, have mercy on your child. I'm yours. You're my father. And this comes up in Abraham, and it comes up also with Moses, is to argue from God's own nature. What was Moses arguing? That God was just. That God had made promises, and he's righteous. He doesn't lie. And so he's appealing to God's nature in his argument. What's Abraham arguing? Are you going to sweep away the just and the unjust? Far be it from the judge of the whole earth to do something like that. He's arguing about God's nature. This is not your nature to behave this way. David argues similarly. You are faithful and righteous. He's asking for help because of who God is, not because of who he is. Remember, I ponder, and I think about what you've done. That verse 5 is super important, because in remembering what God's done in the past and pondering what God's done in the past and thinking about what God's done in the past, what does he conclude? God is faithful. God is righteous. He is full of unfailing love. He has a gracious spirit that leads. And he is, again, faithful toward the end. It says faithful. But this last word is chesed. This word that is translated faithful or faithful love from Hebrew, chesed, means God's committed love, his covenant love. Why does God love me? Because he committed himself to do so, not because I'm lovable. He's committed to do it. He's God. Show me your faithful love, not because I'm worthy, but because you decided I was your kid. And you're full of chesed, faithful love. And I think to argue from God's promises. You know, Moses brought that up. He brought up the patriarchs. You made promises to them. You swore by your own name that you would do a certain thing. So he's referring to the promises. And we can, you know, really all these things, your needs, why argue from your needs if there's not a promise of what God's like, that he's full of mercy? You know, all these things really are rooted in promises he's made and descriptions he has of himself. Argue, you know, the desire to trust God alone. God calls on us to do this. We have a status with God. Why would I argue my status if God hadn't promised I have one? All right, so, but I want to just say, while all these things kind of rest on promises, there are also promises that fit the situation you're in. I've got people in my life who are far from God, and I want them to come toward God, and I say, God is the only being I know of that loves it when you say you promised. You promised to draw all to yourself. You promised to convict of sin and righteousness and judgment. You promised, Lord, that if you were lifted up on the cross, you would draw all to yourself. If I know someone who's kind of stuck and they're stuck in sin, a sinful life, I could go to 1 John 5, and there's a promise there that if I pray for the person who's stuck, God will infuse them with spiritual life. I don't even know what that means, but it's a promise, and I'm going to hold God's feet to the fire because he promised. That was a promise I use often. In Psalm 34, it says that God is close to the brokenhearted. And so if someone's brokenhearted, I go to God and I say, you promised that you would be close with them. I was talking with someone recently who had a period where they were in and out of consciousness for quite a long time. And they said that during that time, they couldn't describe exactly what was said, but they felt like they were having a conversation with God. But the one thing they were left with at the end was God was near and he cared about them. Everything would be okay. And so I can pray this promise for myself or for other people. God, you say you're near the brokenhearted. Please show yourself to them in their distress. You should argue with God at times. You should be specific about what you want. And you should make your case to God. Amen.